Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Nice to have you listening to NPR News. This hour, Donald Trump's chaotic, catastrophic last year as president. One of the rather startling truths that emerges from a new book by Washington Post reporters Carol Lenig and Philip Rucker is how few of the former president's aides, advisors, cabinet members, and fellow Republicans were willing to tell the truth to him and about him. And that was never more obvious than what happened on January 6th and the months that have followed. And that's where we're going to begin. Carol Lenig is a national investigative reporter at the Washington Post, where she won a Pulitzer Prize in 2015. Her new book, co-authored with Philip Rucker, is titled I Alone Can Fix It, and she joins us today from Washington. And Carol, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Carrie, thanks so much for having me. I am delighted to be on Minnesota Public Radio. I have a lot of family in the state, so I hope they're dialed
good.
In as well.
I do too. Hey, your account of what happened on January 6th is so detailed and specific. I just wondered, in listening to the testimony and the questions yesterday in the hearing, whether you heard anything new or that there was anything that shed some light on some of the remaining questions you have about it.
What a good question. I have to say that I didn't hear all of the testimony, but I dialed in for a large portion of it. And much of it followed the reporting that Phil and I did for the book, in the sense of the big overarching themes: how violent it was, how terrifying it was for the police officers and the staff, how many moments could have been the difference between life and death. It was, you know, just a hair's breadth from more fatalities and possibly, you know, real peril for the democracy if certain political leaders had been killed or harmed. I will say that some of the details that the police officers provided were new to me and gripping and frightening, particularly Officer Gunnell describing mm-hmm. not being able to get enough oxygen. So squeezed was he by the protesters around him and the chemical gas that was being sprayed in the air by those charging and storming the Capitol.
Yours and Phil Rucker's account of the moment-by-moment events of the day alternates between inside the West Wing and then in the chaos on Capitol Hill. And as noted in the introduction here, I just found it shocking in the way that people around the former president feared confronting him about what they were seeing, and they were shocked, they were frightened. In a lot of cases, they weren't sure what to do. Your book makes that clear. But here's Mike Pence and Mark Milley and Trump's own daughter are kind of cajoling him and humoring him and tiptoeing around him while they're getting reports that people are being injured and killed inside the Capitol building. And I guess I want you to reflect on how that in some ways exemplified the way this president's whole term went and then what it meant, how it happened in the last year. I mean, was this indicative of the way that Trump managed and the people around him managed?
I think it's really smart that you talk about that bigger point of was it emblematic? And I will say that there were two things going on in the experience of the presidency from the eyes of those who were cabinet members and leaders, really at the shoulder of the president. And keep in mind, these are people who support Donald Trump's policies, his agenda. They're doing everything they can to get him reelected. That's one thing that binds a lot of the individuals I'm talking about. But again, to put it in two pieces, on January 6th, which is really a crisis moment for our democracy, political leaders could have been killed. A coup could have actually occurred. It was in process. Terrible mm-hmm. things could have happened. The vice president could have been killed and harmed. It was seconds away from him running into rioters charging the Senate landing where he had just passed for his evacuation. But back to your point, on January 6th, Mark Meadows and Ivanka Trump, the chief of staff and the president's daughter, are working in tandem over the course of 2 hours to try to convince President Trump to issue a call, basically to call off the dogs, to tell his protesters to stop the violence, to leave the Capitol, and prevent more bloodshed. You know, remember, 5 people died that day, including a police officer for Capitol Police. And they have such a hard time convincing him and cajoling him to say the right thing. But at that moment, Carrie, January 6th, most of the adults in the presidency are gone. The president is listening at that point to conspiracy theorists who tell him that he's won the election fair and square. There are tons of examples of how the election was rigged. He's only tuning in that voice in his ear that says he's not a loser. He won the election. Bill Barr, weeks earlier, is the president's attorney general. And he has told the president privately, according to our reporting, Mr. President, these allegations that your friends are sharing with you, that Michael Flynn, your former national security advisor, that Sidney Powell, a lawyer you've glommed onto, Rudy Giuliani, a tilting at windmills figure in your stable of friends, the things they are telling you are nonsense. We've investigated them. I have the entire Department of Justice at my fingertips. We've looked at them. I want you to be reelected, but it didn't happen, sir. And these fraud claims that your folks have made, this vote rigging, this ballot jiggering, it never happened. That goes to your point, because earlier there are a ton of people trying to tell President Trump the truth, but they're afraid of 2 things. They're afraid of how he treats people that dispute him, the famous firing by tweet. And some of them are afraid of who they'll be replaced by. I'll give you a couple of examples. Defense Secretary Mark Esper is like riding a roller coaster and hanging on for dear life because he's so worried about the loyalists that he has seen the president try to install in the Defense Department that he feels could be part of that coup that General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, fears is afoot. You know, if these loyalists get inside and, as Milley described it to his confidants, get the guys with the guns, they may be able to do what Donald Trump wants. Michael Flynn, one of the president's, you know, whisperers, has been talking in this time period about declaring martial law and that the president could issue such an order so that they could rerun the election, whatever rerun the election means. This is the kind of talk the president is listening to. And Mark Esper in November is trying to just basically hold on to his job to prevent that from happening.
General Milley is, as noted here, chair of the Joint Chiefs, is one of the adults in the room, as you put it, who's still left. And he emerges through the book. I'd love to hear how you characterize, you know, his, I guess, epiphany of what he's dealing with here. But I think he emerges as deeply conflicted about Trump's actions and decisions. How does this evolution happen over the course of this last year? When does he really realize, who he's working for?
Great question. And, you know, I do put General Milley, Kerry, in a slightly different category because he's not a political actor. I mean, he's obviously a seasoned watcher and negotiator of politics, but his job is to give the best military advice to the president. There is a political element in the fact that, again, in the course of this relationship, President Trump chooses Milley as his chairman in large measure because General Mattis, a general that was the Secretary of Defense and with whom President Trump crossed swords, because Mattis told Trump the truth and disputed him to his face. They really had a terrific, colossal breakup. Mattis did not like Milley. And almost to spite him and also to irritate him, the president chooses Milley as his chairman. And so Milley owes him a little something, right? He's gotten the most important job that you can have in the Pentagon and in the military firmament. But Milley becomes concerned, really concerned, after June 1, the clearing of Lafayette Square, in which President Trump sort of has all of his, as many members as he can of his cabinet, along with Milley and Esper and Barr, walk behind him across Lafayette Square to a photo op where the president sort of establishes his control of the city. That photo op, in order for it to be achieved, required federal law enforcement and others to forcibly clear a huge set of city blocks and a park of peaceful protesters who were there to rally for George Floyd, the late George Floyd, and to try to seek redress for systemic racism in police forces around the country, try to get Donald Trump to care about this and do something about it. But when Milley is sort of used in that way, on June 1, he goes to bed pledging to himself, I'm not going to let the military get drawn into and politicized by Donald Trump. I'm not going to let that happen again. He makes that pledge to himself and to some mentors. And as the weeks and months go by, as the president continually tries to undermine absentee ballots and say that people voting remotely are part of a fraud or are subject to fraud, and maybe the election results will be wrong if he doesn't win, when that's happening, Milley is on guard. And he, in the fall, begins to be concerned that actually President Trump is trying to get his hands on the guys with the guns, the CIA, the DOJ, FBI, and the Pentagon. And he is going to be a bulwark against that and make sure that doesn't happen.
Oh, it's just extraordinary. I mean, in the middle of all this, the reporting seems to support the idea that Milley believes a coup is underway. Is that too strong of language, Carol? How would you put what he thinks is happening?
No, it's not too strong. That's exactly what Milley believed was afoot. And he was also getting middle of the night phone calls from people he really trusted to the ends of the earth, telling him, I'm warning you, this new guy they just installed at the Pentagon, danger, danger, danger. He would get calls from the former National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, warning him about specific individuals who'd been at the White House and were now newly, again, installed at the Pentagon, and told Milley, watch your back. These are people that will do things that will shock you. They'll be willing to, and they are acting at the behest of Trump, not in the best interests of the country. And again, keep in mind, in this same time frame, you have Michael Flynn talking about the president's ability to declare martial law. You have individuals around the president talking about how citizens need to take to the streets. You have those rallies in Washington, the Stop the Steal rallies that are the precursor for January 6th, November and December. Again, where Michael Flynn is a star participant talking about how the president did not lose the election, and the people are going to make sure that he stays in power.
There's just one small scene here out of all of this chaos that's happening on January 6th that, I don't know, I found this chilling with all the other detail. Larry Kudlow, who's director of the National Economic Council in the Trump administration and a big on-air, right, media defender of Trump's, he's in his office with another colleague, and they're watching this unfold, and you and Philip Rucker write, they were horrified but they didn't believe there was anything they could do to stop it. These were two of the most powerful people in government, yet what could they do if the president refused to act? I'm trying to think of historical precedents where maybe other people that are that close to the president and that powerful, as you note, have faced a choice and a realization like that.
You know, I can't think of one. I mean, that day to me is still chilling. I remember it like it was earlier this morning in some respects because, you know, shots were fired. Strange people with horns on their heads and two-way radios and weapons were sitting on in Pelosi's desk and at the rostrum of the Senate. Anyone watching television could see it. And yet the president was MIA. He was in his dining room watching the television almost gleefully and not really doing anything to ameliorate the situation, make a difference, reduce the chance of death, reduce the chance of the vice president being killed along with his family. He wasn't calling even to see if he was all right. You know, the person who was really acting as commander in chief on this day was Vice President Pence. Forgive me, catching a breath. Vice President, you know, has a lot of critics for the way that he sat silently, almost like a statue, alongside Donald Trump for some of the wackiest recommendations the president made and strange statements he made. Again, silently, almost as if in agreement. But on January 6th, it was Vice President Pence who was talking to the defense secretary in conference call from a basement secure location, along with the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader, insisting that the Capitol be cleared, that the Army do whatever it needed to do to get that place safe enough for members to return and certify the election. It was really amazing to see that split screen, Donald Trump watching TV and being kind of coddled like a child by his daughter and chief of staff, and Vice President Pence, you know, in hiding for his life, ordered by his Secret Service detail into a basement, refusing to get into his limousine for fear that the Secret Service agents would drive him away and prevent him from certifying the election, calling the Army Secretary and the Defense Secretary from that location, not ideal, with thousands of rioters marching through the Capitol overhead, and demanding that they finish their job.
You know, Carol, I listened to that and having read what the vice president faced on that day and actually through the whole administration, but in this final year, and I think how important it could have been if the vice president would have told this story, explained how it felt to be in the middle of this, just been matter-of-fact and honest with the American people, how that probably would have persuaded some Americans who think this was no big deal. And I just, is it really all about political ambition? Is that the reason that he hasn't come forward to talk about what you're describing?
You know, the Republican Party is in, and everyone who is a star in the party, although Donald Trump is obviously the standard bearer at this moment and would be nominated as the Republican candidate for president if the primary was held tomorrow, the leaders alongside him or around him of the party are in such a terrible bind because in order to win their seats in order to have a chance to be president, as Vice President Pence would like to do, as Mike Pompeo apparently has ambitions for. In order to have a chance, they have to be able to channel that very, very multi-million dollar large, multi-million person large group of people that that rabidly support Donald Trump. And the bind therein is they didn't speak up, to your point earlier. They didn't break with Donald Trump any of the number of times that he challenged and threatened the Constitution. After January 6th, and I'm going to quote a Republican operative who's been in this business for decades, who was talking to me yesterday in an interview. He said that if only the Republicans had basically said no more on the night of January 6th, Donald Trump would have been in disgrace at this moment. If they'd all joined hands and done that together, then he wouldn't have this same grip on that voter base. But they were too fearful of doing that, too fearful of losing their chance for a re-election. And now they're stuck because they have to perpetrate and promote something they know is not true, that President Trump was denied re-election, and they must continue to pretend that January 6th wasn't so bad. The hearings today and yesterday are revealing again, for anyone who is living in La La Land, that this was not a loving crowd, as Donald Trump said. This was not a group hugging and kissing and being ushered in warmly by Capitol Police, but a group that was hell-bent on violent extremist takeover of our government.
Carol Lenig is with us. You're hearing our conversation develop about hers and Philip Rucker's new book, The Washington Post Reporters. The new book, co-authored with Mr. Rucker, is titled I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Years. So we've spent quite a bit of time here so far in the show talking about the detailed, minute-by-minute in some cases, account of what happened on January 6th, and some of the management of the president by the people around him that led to the way they behaved with him on January 6th. If you have questions about that, we're also going to talk about the president's management of the coronavirus. Fascinating information about what's happening as the administration is getting reports and details about this and the behind-the-scenes decision-making, and by the way, self-interest the president is using as he makes these decisions about what to do on the virus. Questions about what you've heard so far, or questions about some of the media reports that you're reading, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can reach me by Twitter at Carrie NPR. Let me grab a call here from Jan before we go to news. Hi, Jan. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. What do you want to say? What are you thinking about as you reflect on our discussion?
I am presently reading Carol's and Phil's book.
Ah, good.
Point number one, everybody says, how come the National Guard wasn't called out sooner? There was only one person in the USA who could call out the National Guard at that moment, and that was Trump. And that's from the mouth of the mayor of Washington, D.C., who said, I would have called him out had I had the authority, but the only authority to call out the guard was President Trump.
Okay, we'll tackle that.
I want to know how hard it must be for Carol and Phil to write the language that these gutter snipes, these backbiting, snarling, self-serving people use. English is a very rich language. It has a lexicon of about 75,000 to 85,000 words. If you can't find a way to express yourself in English, you ain't looking. French has 25,000 words, and they manage.
All right, Jan, I think we've got the idea here, and thank you. If you will, Carol, first to the National Guard issue, because because that is interesting, the way that evolves. Good.
Yeah. So, Jan, I want to say that it is absolutely true that the president is the person who can call out the National Guard on an emergency basis, but that requires the Insurrection Act for most states. I want to emphasize something. In D.C., it's different. The president can call out the National Guard in D.C. But the on that particular day, it was actually the Secretary of Defense to whom that role was delegated. And there was a lot of complication in how slow it was for the National Guard to arrive, the D.C. National Guard. Let me try to take this in three bites. First, the Capitol Police Chief, Stephen Sund, who I interviewed right after January 6th, told me that he had requested National...
Carol's connection might have dropped there. So what we'll do is reconnect with her while we get a look at the latest news. And she'll come back and complete the answer on what was happening with the National Guard and more of your calls and questions on the other side of news. Back with Carol Lenig now about hers and Philip Rucker's book, I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. Are you back with us, Carol?
I am. I'm so sorry. Okay. I don't know how we dropped each other.
We lost you just as you were starting to take the National Guard situation in three bites, and we lost you mid-bite there. So if you'll go back to that.
Absolutely. So the National Guard situation is pretty complicated, but let me just walk you through what really happened. Days before January 6th, Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sund, who I interviewed right after the riot, told me that he had asked for the National Guard to be on standby, the DC National Guard. They're the closest ones. It makes sense. Why did he do that? He was getting intel that said there was going to be a much larger protest in January than there had been in the previous Stop the Steal rallies in December and November in Washington. So he wanted those folks close by. He knew it would take a little time for them to suit up, get ready. They don't move on a dime, but he wanted them close. His bosses at the Capitol, who work for the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, and the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, told him, nah, we don't really want the National Guard up here. It looks bad. So no thank you. So that's that. Then the second thing that happens is on the actual day of the riot, Sund realizes this is a mess before anybody else really does. It's a medieval combat outside. He's watching it on his television screens from his command center. And at 1 o'clock on January 6th, he calls the DC National Guard leader, General Walker, and says, I need your guys pronto. I'm about to get emergency permission for you to come onto the grounds, but please start coming. Come now. I need you. But what he doesn't realize is General Walker at this point doesn't have permission to send his own DC National Guard. Per a memo that was written a few days prior in preparation for January 6th, only the Secretary of Defense has the authority to authorize sending the DC National Guard. This memo was written largely out of fear about a repeat of June 1 at Lafayette Square, when the National Guard appeared to be, you know, quelling civil rights protests, you know, stopping people from their First Amendment rights. And finally, when Sund gets on the call, on a conference call at about 2:30 with the Pentagon and with the Army Secretary's office, he gets a little bit of blowback where some of the National Guard leaders in the Army are saying, well, you know, what are the National Guardsmen going to do? This looks kind of weird. We don't have a clear responsibility or authority there. What's our role? This could be a big mess if our guys show up there. Sund is saying, are you kidding me? A big mess? I have a riot. I have a riot going on here. And in his defense, the chief of police of the DC police is just floored. He said, are you denying an emergency request for National Guard from the Capitol Police Chief? He's just told you he has a riot. So they rush to talk to the Army Secretary, who rushes to talk to the Defense Secretary, all of whom authorize that the National Guard be sent over. But the problem is they're not at the ready. They have to be assembled. It's going to take time for them to get their gear. Then they have to sort of ready up and gather together at a pre-station. It takes hours. 3 hours before they get actually to the Capitol.
Oh. A couple of questions here that are somewhat similar. From Twitter, Lisa says, what outcome is realistic from the House investigation? Will people face consequences? What will it take for supporters of Mr. Trump to finally see him for what he is? And let me add to this with a call from Maureen in Prior Lake. Maureen, it sounds like you have, you're thinking along similar lines. What do you want to know?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for hosting, Carol. There's a lot of readers here in Minnesota who are interested in her book. My question is around whether there can be civil lawsuits related to the January 6th incident. Is it possible for people who were injured? It's been hard to watch the testimony of some of these individuals. Can they take civil lawsuits against former President Trump or any of the other organizers of that insurrection?
It's a good question, Maureen, and the answer is yes. I mean, I'm a journalist. I'm not in the business of recommending legal strategy, but that absolutely is an option and has been an option for a lot of people who've been harmed, including people who've been harmed because of government failure or government complicity and negligence. There are many individuals that Phil and I interviewed for the book who strongly believe that the president's allies and aides were playing an organizing role in this attack on the Capitol. And what this goes to the original part of the question that I heard about what will this investigation really find. The central questions that have not been answered are who organized what was obviously a special ops tactical operation. As Chief Sun from the Capitol Police told me, you know, guys don't come with two-way radios and with climbing gear and weaponry out of nowhere with no plan. And in fact, another thing to remember is while supporters were listening to President Trump sort of whip them up at the ellipse and talk about how the election was stolen from him and thanking them for coming and trying to stop the steal for him, as they were there waiting for him to finish his speech, a small sort of, again, Delta Force was already assembling near the Capitol, near the top of the Capitol, and moving their way up, snaking their way up the side of the hill. So this was pretty organized, and there is a lot of indication that people close to Donald Trump, people talking with the White House, knew there was a plan to storm the Capitol, knew there was a plan that was more than just a rally to show support for the president. As for civil lawsuits, I can also see a situation in which individuals who were harmed could argue that key members of the administration let them down, fell down on the job, participated in the sense of not taking action. But I don't know that that will happen. I just know that it is certainly a possibility.
I want to ask you a bit about the coronavirus, because, boy, I found this really insightful. We've talked about some of this kind of fearful enabling that went on around Trump for much of the administration, particularly in the last year, and then around January 6th. And that seems to be happening as the pandemic is gathering steam. So you write about, you know, Nancy Messonnier, Alex Azar, Anthony Fauci, Robert Redfield as head of the CDC. They're all, you know, they all want to and try to level with Americans about the nature of the threat. And it sounds like they end up being undermined, threatened with dismissal, sidelined from the media, even though many of the people around Trump clearly knew and were warning him personally that this was not how the country ought to be served as a pandemic is bearing down. How would you characterize the way, you know, his closest team and advisors were reacting? And does it look a lot like what they were doing on January 6th with the pandemic?
You know, the way that President Trump and the White House handled this series of moments that you're referring to was really public health malpractice, because in every instance you describe, and which we report in far more detail, of course, in the book, in every instance they are trying to put a lid on truth, put a lid on useful information people needed to protect themselves. I'll give you those two examples with a little more flesh. In the case of Nancy Messonnier, she takes to basically a daily news call with reporters about the pandemic, at that point they're not calling it a pandemic, about the virus. She takes to this rostrum basically to say we all need to be prepared for pretty dramatic changes in our daily life as families, as schools, as governments, as institutions. We are going to have to take some dramatic steps. That's a paraphrase, but that's what she said. President Trump, seeing the markets start to react to this news, the first time really someone in the government has sort of spoken truth to power, the markets are starting, they'd already been a little bit anxious about the virus, and now they start to show a really sharp decline. That infuriates the president, because what does he have as the greatest, arrow in his quiver? The economy is going gangbusters. So now that's a problem for him. He calls Alex Azar from Air Force One as he's traveling back from a foreign country and says, Alex, get her away from the microphone. Who the hell is this? Forgive me. And I think he actually said it with a more dramatic expletive. And, you know, she is crashing the markets. Do what you need to do. Azar tries to explain to the president that everything she said is accurate. And privately to himself and to aides, he says, you know, her one mistake was she got in front of the president. She got in front of it before he communicated this and endorsed this message. But the truth was the president was never going to endorse this message. He wanted happy talk. There's no virus. The economy's doing great. A few people are sick. The numbers are going to go down. As he said, it's just going to miraculously go away. Well, we all know that's not the case. The second instance where the president basically puts, again, a lid on truth that could have helped people protect themselves was when Mark Meadows insists that nobody from the health community, the experts in charge, gets on TV and says any more about this unless they're authorized by the White House. Now, White Houses generally try to control the message. They do. There's no question about it. They do that for political reasons. Every presidency does that. But in this case, the White House is trying to keep information from the public, like masks actually help protect you and your family members from transmitting and getting the virus. They try to stop the talk that Fauci is sharing with people, and that is, this is a pandemic. This is going to be not the 1900s flu, but this is going to be serious. People are going to die. People needed that alarm bell, right? There were so many states in the spring and the summer of 2020 that had huge numbers of people still saying this virus was nothing. It was a hoax made up by the Democrats. And it would take months before they would see in their less dense communities that whole families were getting sick. Older members of those families were on intubators, struggling for breath, and many of them were dying. All of that could have been mitigated had the White House and the president not set that tone at the beginning of hide the public health facts from the public.
I want to ask you about, there's a lot of speculation about why Trump, having authorized and talked up Operation Warp Speed, has not been more forceful about recommending his followers and Republicans get the vaccine. And I was listening to the Bulwark podcast a week or so ago, and David Frum, the conservative writer, was on, and he posited a theory, and I want you to listen to this and tell me whether this matches, you know, what you're hearing and reporting on. Let's listen.
They were locked into COVID denial. They treated the COVID as a criticism of Trump, a reflection on Trump, and they were locked into the denial through 2020. So you can't make the vaccines the miracle that they are, because that would mean the problem actually was big all along. And if the vaccine is a miracle, then the problem was real. And if the problem was real, then Trump was unspeakably negligent in the spring and summer of 2020.
What do you think, Carol?
Well, I have to say, I like the way he put it about COVID denial. And absolutely, that is playing out now in real time. The president, forgive me, Donald Trump, the former president, just a few days ago, talked about how he understands why his supporters distrust the vaccine. He understands why they distrust the Biden government. You know, that is not helpful at a time when the deaths that we are seeing around the country are among overwhelmingly 94% among people who have not been vaccinated. Now, President Trump is just not consistent as a president in 2020 about all of this. Initially, he said it wasn't a big deal. Then he said he was the amazing person who delivered the vaccine. And he does deserve some credit for pushing like heck to get the vaccine developed, mostly for his own political gain. But he did put incredible pressure on his health agencies to verify, test, and get that vaccine developed, he hoped, before Election Day. So to now say that the amazing delivery of that vaccine is easily distrusted makes no sense in terms of caring about Americans. But it makes a lot of sense if you're Donald Trump and what you want is to continue to be a force, a power in the Republican Party, somebody who continues to make people afraid and feel that you are their savior and defender.
You write about what happens when it becomes clear that President Trump has COVID. Is it now clear that he was sicker than the country knew? And I just want to acknowledge that I know that has happened with other presidents, Ronald Reagan included, when they faced health crises. But what do you now understand about how sick the president was?
You know, for the Washington Post, where I work, we were working like the Dickens to tell people in real time, you know, what is the state of the president's health? And we got a lot of good material that we published. But when we went back for the book to research this more deeply, we learned a lot more. And what we learned was that he was quite deathly ill, and that his White House physician, his doctor, was quite concerned that they had to pull out all the stops to make sure he did not become incapacitated. That is Sean Conley, the White House physician, called both Tony Fauci and Robert Redfield, the CDC director, to consult with them privately about the president's health once he was found to be positive for COVID. They had a pulse oximeter test and found that his oxygen levels had dropped precipitously to that level that is considered, you know, the teetering point between disaster and stability. So patients with that situation can quickly fail and there's no return. Pulling out all the stops for Sean Conley was getting him on an aggressive, and to be fair, experimental set of treatments that included monoclonal antibodies and remdesivir. The monoclonal antibodies were not something you and I could have gotten at that time. But it was really important to the White House physician that, again, they give him the kitchen sink. And Redfield told friends and allies that night that he prayed for the president because he felt as if there was a very high chance that he was going to have to be intubated, that he was going to be in an ICU. That both men were talking about how important it was to get the president to a hospital immediately, although the president was resisting it. And ultimately, Conley prevailed and Redfield's view prevailed, and against the president's wishes, they took him to the hospital. Trump's biggest concern, according to our reporting, what we learned for the book, his biggest concern was looking weak by being taken to a hospital. And his next biggest concern was being temporarily sidelined, because if he were put on oxygen, if he were in an ICU, there was a very good chance that he would have to be temporarily replaced by Vice President Pence. And he adamantly did not want that.
And why? And we've got about a minute left here.
You know, Donald Trump is the I alone can fix it guy. He didn't think that Pence should ever take his place. That would be an insult to him. And again, optics are everything to Donald Trump. He was beside himself at the idea in June 1 that foreign leaders were laughing at his ability to control security around the White House. That was his biggest concern. Not that George Floyd had died, not that Black Lives Matter protesters were despondent, not that there was evidence of systemic racism, but honestly, just he was focused on what will make me look good.
Carol, I hope your friends and family members were tuned in this morning. Thank you so much for a really insightful conversation. Good to have you.
I so enjoyed it. Thank you.
Carol Lenig's book, along with Philip Rucker, is I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year.
NPR News with Carrie Miller is produced by Kelly Gordon and Ariana Rosas. Today's technical director was Veronica Rodriguez. Miss a show? Search for NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.